Then you kind of, were you going to comment?
I guess I'd be kind of repeating what they're saying. I mean, I was just going to say it refers to, I mean, we do it today in, you know, 114. I think this document, I guess the final document will refer to the 114, but it does say as possible methods. So to Jim's point, it'll be interesting to see where practice goes. So when you ask the auditors, I think the first question is going to be is, what are preparers going to do, right? And evaluate what preparers do. And so we're going to audit what they do. It's not like we're doing a split here, right? And so what is the efficacy of the processes they're going to put in place to separate this, and how wide are the methods going to be? To the extent that there's, you know, that's not very wide, I think our job gets a little bit easier that year into the you know, the assumptions. But you start using a lot of different, you know, many, many different models. I think this came up, Gary, at the FASAC meeting the other day. You know, the many models you go, the wider you go, the more difficult it becomes.
Okay, I think we'll get back to the main. But, Jeff, you had asked another question about inspections, whether or not we would look at that. And I can't answer specifically for inspections program, but generally we have a risk-based focus, looking at engagements, the type of risk areas, and we do look at how auditors audit companies' financial statements and internal controls over financial reporting. So I'd expect if this is an area that's selected, that certainly the audit, you know, that we would look at that as part of the inspection process. Okay, Bill Miller.
Thank you. Yes, with regard to, I guess, potential guidance, my sense is this is going to be very complicated. And by way of example, and I'll let the auditors determine whether this is correct or not, but if you go down the path of saying you audit the holdings of B of A, Chase, and AIG, and you're all one audit firm, and another audit firm is doing Goldman Sachs, and let's assume that, you know, these are all complicated structured securities, and that no one entity owns an entire issue, then I guess there's going to have to be some commonality of assumptions. Otherwise, you're going to get valuations for the same security or family of securities valued very differently in one firm versus another, versus one audit firm versus another audit firm, perhaps. And I think, well, it's my view that when you're looking at companies from an investment perspective, you need to have some degree of comparability. So to address that, I think you're going to have some disclosures to help with that.
Gail Hansen.
I think my point was along the same line. When management is going to make this determination between the split between, with the other than temporary impairment, between credit and other, and presumably the same security on two different sets of books could be valued differently. And I don't know whether that's anticipated by the FASB or by the accounting firms of saying, can you give an opinion that the same security valued in valued differently on two different companies that you audit is fair? And where do you draw the line saying this company can use that value and that company can use a different value on the exact same security? For dividing the other than temporary impairment.
I have a brief comment on that. I don't think that's a new issue. I mean, I think that's an issue that's been around for a long time, that whether it's evaluation of loan loss reserves or valuing a security, it's up to the preparer to prepare their financial statements and the auditor to come up with the reasonableness of all of those assumptions. And I doubt that the exact same amount is recorded for a security on all institutions today or the same loan loss reserve for similar loans. So I think that's an issue that exists. That's not new.
Gary Kaburek.
Actually, Vin made some of the points I was going to make, but I'll repeat them. I mean, we're talking about difficult to audit. Well, I can assure you as preparers that's equally difficult to create. And although there's audit risk and there's also management risks in the 302 and 906 certifications during the year and so on. So your clients have got the exact same issues, and I would argue probably a higher degree of expectations because it's our representations, you know, when the numbers. I just don't want to lose sight of that. I think, personally, I think going through FASAC and stuff, I actually giving the difficulties, the situation, the collective circumstance, I think actually the FASB has been pretty, very responsive in trying to address these issues as, you know, as quickly as they can. And I think, although it's perhaps more work could be done if time was permitted, I think we're still way ahead of where we might have been 3 years ago. If we didn't have 157 3 years ago, we'd have had a lot more variety in how to value these things, whether it's a net realizable value, a mark-to-market, you know, an estimated value, and so on. So I still think we're collectively better off with where we are off the FASB's discussion today in it. So just a comment.
Thank you. Hal Schroeder.
Just two quick observations. My condolences to the audit professionals here. From what my credit people tell me, you're going to have a hell of a time. They kind of just shrugged their shoulders when they read this section and kind of went, what would you like the number to be? And so you're going to get, unfortunately, to your observation, you're going to get a fairly wide range of differences. And these are people who do it for a living, day in and day out. And so what I assume that will happen is that you'll have a fairly extensive summary of audit differences, because you will get different clients who have different answers for the same basic investment. You may come back, and I'm guessing you'll come back with what you think the fair number is that is applicable to everybody, and some people will be above that and some people below that, and they'll all end up in the summary of audit differences. And with their material, then you'll make whatever judgments you have to at that point in time. Is that basically how the process would work?
Do the firms want to comment?
Well, I'll try. I don't think that's the way it'll work, Al. I mean, I don't think we are going to sit with one spot, one person sitting somewhere in New York saying, here's the way that security is going to get valued every place it shows up. So I don't think we're going to have a one firm answer that we then consider where a particular client falls in the range. I'm struck by, and I won't get this quote right, but it came from an American Assembly report, and it was something about the brittle illusion of exactitude in financial accounting and reporting. I mean, these things are estimates. You could take two loans held, a participation loan held by two banks, and when it starts going south, as Marcus, then I get exactly the same answer unless it's a shared national credit, and someone does come in and say, this is the valuation you put on that particular loan. This isn't new. It's the times are something we haven't faced before. But you're going to have different valuations by different companies that are accepted by different auditors, or maybe even the same firm, but different auditors. That's happening today. That's going to happen after these FSPs are passed. And there just seems to be a misunderstanding that those financial reports are so precise that couldn't happen. The fact is, they're very relevant, but they're not so precise that you're going to get the same answer on something that is filled with that much estimation.
Damon Silvers.
I serve on another body, the Congressional Oversight Panel for the TARP. In that context, we have looked at comparative U.S. historical and international approaches to banking crises, which it seems to me, and I don't speak for that panel, but just for me, and we've held hearings on this, and one of the things that we have found is that there are two different approaches that have been tried in banking crises to problems of valuation on bank balance sheets, which have implications for auditing. The first approach is essentially administrative pricing, which is more or less what I think we are talking about trying to audit, meaning essentially some form of discounted cash flows associated with the assets, with a non-market measure of what the discount rate is. This only works, historically, in my opinion, if the people doing it are not the management of the firm. If you ask incumbent management to do this, there's only one instance in comparative banking crises that we know of where incumbent management was asked to do this, and that instance was Japan. And it's widely understood to have been a contributor to the prolonged nature of that crisis. We are clearly, in this case, asking auditors to audit the firm's own sort of self-estimate of these numbers. And I think that the likelihood of success is not great based on historical comparison. And I think that furthermore, there seems to be an immediate issue that the board will face in its work overseeing that. And that is that the temptation to look, as someone I think said a few moments ago, to the internal implied discount rates in these securities. If that's the starting point, then it strikes me that none of this will have any integrity whatsoever. You cannot possibly look at the cash flows of impaired securities, of securities that are being priced below par, and then assume that you apply the discount rate that was implied when the security was issued at par. If issuers are starting there, then the board has a very large job in front of it. I think that the seriousness of these issues is very great. If financial reporting, if the output, which is not the same thing as the standard that the FASB has articulated, but if the output that arises at the end of the audit process here, right, is fundamentally not output that can be effectively used by a variety of decision makers, including quite importantly public sector decision makers who are having to decide what to do with sick institutions. If the output is not reliable, the consequences, not just for investors in those firms or the management, employees and so forth of those firms, but the consequences for our economy and for our society may be very great. I don't mean to make anyone here any more depressed than they might otherwise be, but I think that the board has a very great obligation here. The PCAOB has a very great obligation here to ensure that whatever we do not repeat the Japanese experience here, that we get numbers that can be used. And I would further add, just in conclusion, that in parallel with this process, which you all are overseeing, in many of the institutions that are the largest institutions that are most severely affected here, the Treasury Department is in parallel doing stress tests. And if it turns out that there's a real risk to the credibility of the audit process, the audit firms, and the financial reporting system, if numbers start getting generated out of the process that comes out of FASB's changes as mediated through the audit process and through the PCAOB's oversight of that audit process, if the outputs are wildly at odds with what turns out to come from either the stress tests or from potentially much more rigorous sorts of things comparable to those that were used successfully in other process, in other financial rescues, that may follow on the stress tests should we have continuing problems with the balance sheets and overall health of our major financial institutions.
Damon, I know there's a lot of comments in there, and we appreciate them. I think the first thing Mark had said earlier is we will, when we finally see these FSPs, determine, first of all, what conforming amendments are necessary on the auditing standards, but whether additional guidance is necessary. So we will go through that. Just one other point I want to make, and I think that when you were talking about using the rate implicit in the security to discount cash flows, as I understand it, and Peter, you can comment if I get this wrong, that's not for the purpose of determining fair value. That's for the purpose of only determining the incurred credit loss that should be recorded through the earnings statement in the 115 on the other than temporary impairment. So that's that rate is only for that incurred credit loss that should be recorded through earnings, no suggestion that that's the rate that should be used in the determination of fair value. Peter, any?
That's correct.
My concern would be in relation to the question of what rate do you use, right, that it seems to me a very difficult task to figure out how to audit that decision in light of what you've been provided with, and that how one would inspect against those audits seems quite challenging. And what I wanted to emphasize to the board was the enormous stakes here in doing that effectively. and the very real possibility that the success or failure of the process of financial reporting and auditing will not be something that's looked back on in 10 years, but in 10 months.
Wayne Collins.
The discussion we've been having for the last, I don't know, 45 minutes or so, you know, certainly significant in terms of the issue that we're focusing on, but certainly seems like it's part of a broader issue when you're dealing with what is apparently, you know, a principles-based standard that both issuers and auditors have to comply with. And to assess how each one does his or her job in that respect without some kind of a professional judgment framework is a very difficult task. And this will not be the only standard that we're dealing with like that. And, you know, CIPR had that, at least the early recommendation, it kind of evolved a little differently. But for both the PCAOB and the FASB to have some kind of an approach, a framework for making reasoned professional judgments that could be accepted as long as the reason was applied appropriately.
Kurt Shaw.
Thanks. I just wanted to say for the record, just to get this out there, that speaking for one user group, I want to just say how much we appreciate the strong job that audit firms are doing under very difficult circumstances, and we really do look to you as sort of our last line of defense on this. Just for a second, I'm tempted to think about liability limits, but that passes very quickly.
Hal Schroeder.
I don't know if this is the right forum to bring this up in, but Jim mentioned liquidity discounts earlier, and I'm just listening to some of the comments from Damian. This seems to me to have real implications for investors, and Gail and I were talking earlier today. I said, you know, one of the things that I've heard from investors is they make an investment in a hedge fund, and let's say they bought that hedge fund investment at 100. If the price of the underlying securities, and assume they're all very liquid, very actively traded securities, they're all level one assets. If the price of the value of that fund goes from 100 to 115, what we're hearing from investors is the auditors are coming in and putting an immediate liquidity discount on the 115. Even though they're all level one, they're all fair value, we're comfortable with 115. The basis for this, and there seems to be a really inconsistency in practice here, is that you cannot access that money for 3 years. There's a three-year lockup, which is very, very typical. It was agreed upon on the front end. And what I'm concerned about is that there may be pension funds, endowments, and others who come in and say, I make a $100 investment today, and I'm going to, because there's a three-year lockup, there's been no movement in the underlying assets, but I'm immediately going to lose 5, 10, 15%. And so therefore I will not make the investment. And so I'd be very curious as to, you know, where do we fall on that spectrum? Is this an accounting issue? Is it an audit issue? It seems to me to be both issues, and this is real life. This is what's happening out there. And we're getting different accounting answers or different audit answers, if you will, from different firms.
Does anyone want to comment on Hal's question? Ian, were you going to make another point?
Well, no, just believe it or not, I just had a reaction. If the thought is that you could put your money in today but can't get it for 3 years, it seems to me that you've given up the use of your money for 3 years without getting anything back. So therefore, it seems to me that it's not worth the dollar you put in. I mean, call me crazy.
Okay. No.
Ben Coleman?
Moving the conversation up a level, though, I think that what this does, there's been discussions, I mean, at the FASB around You know, there's a separate group dealing with valuation, right? And I think that the expertise, I think this is demonstrating, particularly in these difficult times, how I think our profession is going to need to continue to evolve with respect to valuation skills and using, you know, specialists when you get into very, you know, unique and different types of securities. But more broadly, I think the general practitioner's knowledge of valuation, whether it's here, and by the way, there's other applications. This is financial instruments. I mean, we deal with impairments, and there's all sorts of what we've just gone through. I mean, if you go through this year end, you know, back to your overall topic of emerging issues, I mean, we've gone through, you know, a time where the markets, you know, have changed, and there's been impairment analysis and moves to fair value of other assets on the balance sheet, right? And so it has shown a real need for valuation expertise in our profession. I just think that's something that we should all consider and be aware of.
Thanks. Bob Dacey?
I was just going to make a slightly different point earlier. I put my tent down, but I'll answer anyway since I was going before. But in any case, it had to do with, in the end, a lot of this will be the interpretation of the language which ultimately comes out in the FASB documents and whether or not management's interpretation of that language is the same as the auditor's or not. And I guess any time you have new language in a standard, there's always some diversity of practice, and over time it tends to normalize. I guess I don't know if we have an expectation that additional steps should be taken now to try to make that process work faster to get to that point because of the situation we're in or not. But it just seems to me, in thinking of actions the PCAOB may take, I don't think we can do a whole lot in unilaterally here, but trying to figure out how do we work with, again, interpreting that guidance that comes out in the same way. And I don't know how to best do that because I don't think that's typically what's been done.
Bill Miller.
Yeah, I guess I want to respond to your point, Harold, from the standpoint that when we make investments, or my experience with investing in venture capital or real estate or in illiquid hedge funds with large time period gates, and being a long-term investor, if I've got a three-year time horizon there and they're going to tell me they're going to mark it down a little bit, it doesn't particularly trouble me that much. And at the same time, I think there's a little positive incentive there, too, because, you know, if that goes up a lot, the hedge funds are getting a 2 and 20. It's based on the high watermark, obviously, but they're getting it sooner than they would have. They get it later when it's priced a little less. So there's a little bit of economics there. So I'm not that troubled by that.
Okay, Jeff Mahoney.
Thank you. Just a comment on Damon's remarks. With respect to whether these two proposals will make the resulting information more reliable or not, most of the financial experts I have spoken to, and again, this is based on the proposals, we don't know what the final language is, but most of the financial experts I have spoken to have said no, these two proposals will not make the information more reliable.
Okay, I don't see any more tent cards. We spent quite a lot of time on this, and it has been an important topic, so I thank you for your input in connection with this issue. I'd like to continue, open up the discussion to emerging issues more generally, things that you all have been seeing or hearing about, as far as what we should be focusing on at the PCAOB auditing issues. So interested in thoughts, comments on other things, emerging issues, and I see Galen Hansen.
I continue here from the smaller filers, and I know that you probably can't tell me anything other than you're thinking about it, but the SEC, there's a lot of questions about 404B and when that's going to kick in and whether that's going to be this year or not, and if it's just continuing to be uncertain and we don't know, that's fine, but the sooner that that question gets cleared up, the better it's going to be for the small companies.
My SEC colleagues want to address that?
Sure. Be happy to. We're going to... Excuse me. Yes, it's very emotional. We get broken up every time. We're obviously going through a very extensive cost study right now. It's taking quite a bit of time. We are very cognizant of the fact that people need to line up resources and need to be given a clear signal. I think this is something that, you know, we are going to study very carefully, and if we're not in a position to reach a decision in a timely manner, I'm sure the commission will try to clarify that as soon as they can. Absent that, I can't give you any more specifics.
Thanks, Paul. Greg Jonas?
Two pension issues and a point about debt covenants. The two pension issues, first, as we've all been reading about in the paper, a number of pension plans have in recent years invested ever more in so-called alternative investment vehicles, and to the point where some pension plans now have a majority of their assets in alternative investments. I think there is a risk that because the pension assets are netted against the pension liabilities, that the rigor and discipline over the valuation of these alternative assets that reside in a pension plan would be less than if those same assets resided directly on a company's balance sheet. Yet, the impact on the financial statements can be just as significant of an error in the measurement of those kinds of assets. So maybe a reminder of people that, you know, as pension plans have morphed into these perhaps Category 3 type assets, that business as usual and just looking at the pension valuation may not work. We may need to do more robust procedures. I also understand that we're going to have this year, 2009, new disclosure about those Category 3 assets and pension plans, and reminding folks about that might be helpful, because I think they're going to be subject to the Category 3 disclosure requirements. Second point about pension plans is, you know, 'tis the season to be settling and curtailing and restructuring pension plans in response to the financial stress that everybody's under. In my experience, particularly accountants who haven't seen curtailments or settlements of pension plans, the accounting is not entirely intuitive. Has to be studied, and oftentimes consultation with an expert is useful, or you get the wrong answer. I say this because I used to frequently get the wrong answer, and so maybe a reminder about, you know, the importance of study of the standards with regard to curtailments in these circumstances is useful. And then finally, with regard to covenants, you know, a lot of companies have blown through their covenants under the stressful conditions. Those who haven't are right now a lot closer to blowing through covenants than they often were before. Covenants do a couple of things as they get particularly close to being tripped. It certainly sends signals as to where audit risk might reside for companies who might choose to play some games. They're likely to do it in a way that would avoid tripping the covenants, because once they're tripped in these kind of times, it really turns the company upside down. So perhaps a reminder about that would be useful.
Galen Hansen. Damon Silvers.
An issue I think I'm fairly certain you haven't thought about in the way I'm going to outline it to you. It's related to the last discussion, but it's not quite the same thing. I'm convinced, based on what I have seen, that in the oversight role I play over TARP, which relates to our mortgage markets, I'm convinced that in many, many cases, hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of cases, those who control residential, those who control the management of residential mortgages are failing systematically to engage in win-win restructurings of those mortgage loans with people who can't afford to pay. I can't figure out why that's true, and I'm not alone in not being able to figure that out. It's one of the great policy conundrums of our time. But I have a suspicion that there is an accounting reason somewhere there. That there is an unavoidable, that when a mortgage is restructured, there is an unavoidable kind of tangibleness to what its new value is, and that has something to do with this paradox. Now, what does that have to do with the PCAOB? It seems to me that in looking at financial institutions and with assets that either are home mortgages or backed by home mortgages, that the failure to engage in restructurings seems to me an indicia that there may be an effort to maintain values for those mortgages that are not actually supportable. That is the only way I can explain the refusal to take actions that could result in 60-70% recoveries in favor of actions that result in 40% recoveries. And this is an insight into whether or not, as you look at financial institutions, as to whether or not the valuation of impaired mortgages is actually supportable or not. And I urge you to think about a way to incorporate that into your inspections.
Thank you. Gary?
I would just like to build on something Greg had said earlier when he talked about the expanded disclosures for pension plan footnote assets. Late last year, we took a look at could we actually early adopt the standard. That was seemingly a theme at the time on expanding fair value disclosures. And I would tell you, if you've got a large pension plan, it's going to have alternative assets as part of a normal diversified portfolio. Hopefully not too many, but diversified, alternative assets. If you think real estate, you've got REITs, you've got direct ownership, you might have mortgages inside it, they might be in fixed incomes, asset-backed securities, private equity, and so on and so on. What I would just give the advice to the room, if you've got a pension plan that has these in some consequential amounts, as you go in for the fiscal 09, I think that's when 132R is effective, I wouldn't wait to the end. It's going to be a lot more challenging to do than you're likely to think. I don't know if you need any additional auditing standards on top of it. I mean, I think if we had started a few months earlier, we probably could have gotten there. But, I mean, these things are very difficult to do. I mean, the people that value them, but they don't necessarily line up with the subdivisions inside 157 and so on. So just a heads-up advice is just don't wait too late to get started on it.
That's good. Any other comments regarding emerging issues? Okay, believe it or not, we're going to take a break for 30 minutes because our next session will be the last one on going concern, a panel discussion, and we are scheduled to have a 2-hour and 15-minute discussion on that. We'll take a break now, and we'll resume in 30 minutes. Thank you.